with housing that is substandard in other ways, whether we're talking about rodent infestation, whether we're talking about not having adequate heating or plumbing, whether we're talking about serious mold issues, there can be aspects of the housing that make it so unsafe that its habitability is essentially gone, that you have a roof over your head, but that you still don't have any of anything that we would call the comforts of home. So with that as the introduction, good evening, Ian.
Hello.
Good evening, Elisa. I'm sorry about getting your name wrong.
Hello there, Michael.
I know.
No, it's all right.
Yeah, I know you know my last name, so I should at least extend the courtesy live in the air, but I beg your forgiveness. So tell me a little bit about Community Alliance of Tenants.
Okay. The Community Alliance of Tenants is a grassroots tenant-controlled tenant membership organization. So we have a membership made up of renters throughout Oregon. Any renter in Oregon can become a member of CAT. And we do have members across the state, though most of our organizing activity takes place in the Portland area, in Portland specific. And so the majority of our members are from Portland and the Portland metropolitan area. We've been around for a decade now, doing a combination of tenant education and community organizing around the issues that our members prioritize. And for the life of the organization, there's been a pretty consistent focus on three key areas. The first is the lack of affordable housing. The second is unjust evictions, particularly the existence of no-cause evictions in Oregon. And the third is the difficulty that renters have getting repairs made when landlords are unresponsive.
So, and I think that sort of leads into our next subject area. One of the things that I think is so impressive about the Community Alliance of Tenants is the service that you offer, that is your renters' rights hotline, a one-of-a-kind service for tenants who have questions about what their rights and responsibilities are. Do you want to talk a little bit about that hotline as a lead-in to our subject tonight?
Sure. The hotline's a volunteer-staffed hotline. It's hotline's a bit of a misnomer. It's staffed by volunteers, and how it works is we have a message number that's 503-288-0130. And tenants that are experiencing problems can call the hotline and leave a message. And then when we have volunteers in returning calls, they'll call people back to give folks information about their rights. It's not staffed by attorneys, so we can't give people legal information, but we can give folks information about the law and tips and strategies for addressing problems that folks have. And since we started the hotline, we've counseled over 22,000 renters in Oregon that have called about problems. And pretty consistently over the life of the hotline, two issues have been the issues we receive the most calls about. And those are evictions and repairs. And over the last couple of years, repairs has consistently been the issue that we get the most calls about.
Elisa, in terms of when tenants...
I just want to shamelessly plug our website.
Yes.
Just because if not a hotline, we'll get jam-packed. So it's the only hotline in the state of Oregon, and so it gets full really fast. So there's a wait list. But you can check out our information on our website, which is www.oregoncat.org, and that's C-A-T cat. So all our information is on there, and if you have additional questions, then go ahead and call the hotline. But be a little patient because it's the only one for the whole state of Oregon for tenants that's anything like this.
And again, you're volunteer driven, and it's so. Let's talk about so over the hotline, there's repair issues that come up, and particularly sometimes issues about some basic habitability. Do you want to give some examples of the type of calls that you get?
Yeah, I was talking. I was working the hotline this afternoon. I was talking to folks. There was two folks I talked to today that have no heat. And it is January, and it's mm-hmm. pretty cold outside. They've been going without heat for about 3 days.
Wow.
So I think that's pretty uncomfortable. I think it's pretty cold outside. And if their houses are really cold, and they're asking for repairs, and some of their landlords are just telling them, you know, you got to deal with it, or, you know, yeah, I'll go and look into it. And that was like a week ago, and they were starting to get faulty, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. So there's that. We always get mold and kind of pest problems. So roaches or rats tend to be common, and mold is pretty big. It's out of the repairs, it's probably one of the number one things that we get calls about. And it's sad because a lot of people who have mold problems tend to have illnesses associated with that, or they've noticed that that they get these common symptoms that they don't know if it's the mold, but it seems to be getting worse and as the mold gets worse in their housing too. So,
and I'm just going to put a guess out there too, that maybe folks who are calling that would have mold in their home, not have enough money to afford to move out, might be some of the same people who don't have the healthcare coverage they would need to be able to check out quickly and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard, and I usually try to refer folks, if they don't have medical insurance, to different kind of community-based things, whatever you can do to get some help, because it gets pretty bad. And, you know, asthma has been known to be triggered by mold. And so I've gone into different apartments and I've seen like 3-month-old babies to young children that are wheezing because of their housing conditions. And it's because the mold is in the closets, it's on the carpets and in the bathrooms. And folks are doing what they can, but they're limited.
So in response, I guess, to this long pattern that you've seen of these kind of complaints, CAT has been developing a new program. I guess it's not brand new. It's something that's been going on for a while, but it's called the Safe Housing Project. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things, in addition to the types of calls that we've noticed over the life of the hotline, is that there's very few good tools for tenants to address housing problems when landlords are unresponsive. Most of the tools that are available to tenants require tenants be able to use the legal system, and most tenants don't have the time or resources to effectively use the legal system to force landlords to make repairs. Often what tenants hear when they make repair requests is, if you don't like it, move. And that's obviously not an option for a lot of tenants. The costs associated with moving are very high, both in terms of effort and time and money. And then especially for folks with families, with kids, the price of moving is on children's education is really high, because there's a cost associated with the ability of kids to keep up in school with frequent moves that are pretty well documented. And so families that we talk to, that's a high priority, is keeping a stable house for their kids, even if there's problems. And so finding better tools out there to ensure that folks can get repairs in the houses that they have, and not just forcing low-income people to move from place to place to try and find the elusive, safe and stable housing is one of the things that we're working on.
And to not have to settle for sub-quality, housing. And I'm not talking about like luxury apartments, like to have like a bubbly bathtub and all this stuff, but just have stuff that's functioning and working in locks that work.
Let me ask a question for clarification before we hear a little bit more about this program. Because, Ian, one of the things I heard you say is that there's laws that, for instance, would say a landlord needs to supply heat, a landlord needs to make some basic repairs. But what you said is that when you're at a certain income level, even if there's laws there, you might not be able to access your rights fully. Explain a little bit more why that would be.
Well, that's absolutely correct. There's the enforcement mechanisms for state law are woefully inadequate. The context, particularly for low-income tenants, is that there is a huge shortage of affordable housing. So people with limited incomes have very few housing options that they can afford at all. And then once folks are in housing, in private rental market, Oregon state law allows landlords to evict tenants with only 30 days written notice and not have a reason. It's against the law for landlords to use 30-day no-cause evictions for retaliatory or discriminatory purposes, but there's little practical protection from landlords doing that. Tenants have to be able to stay and fight an eviction in court, and if they lose, they're stuck with the legal costs of the landlord. If they win or lose, they have an eviction on their record that can create a barrier for renting in the future. And so the combination of the lack of affordable housing and the threat of retaliation really limits tenants' ability to assert their rights once they're in housing. In Portland and some other local jurisdictions around the state, there's additional housing maintenance codes that local jurisdictions have. We're lucky in that sense in Portland that there is a housing maintenance code that the city does some enforcement of. But similarly, the problem with that code is that it's a complaint-driven enforcement system, so tenants risk retaliation when they use it.
So just to put that back, to make sure I have this straight for myself and our listeners, that for most of the state, although there's laws on the books that would give you protection, that you it's a high risk on your end if you challenge that protection, if you can't afford a lawyer, because you very likely could lose. Some of these things are hard to prove, and then you'd be stuck with the legal bills. Or, as you said, you could just get one of these 30-day no-cause evictions, and then that sounds like you're stuck up the creek without a paddle. In Portland, we got it slightly better, but still the tenant is in a place that they have to step forward and, in a sense, expose themselves as the, quote, complainer just to get their legal rights met. Is that the current situation?
That's correct. In most parts of the state where there isn't any sort of local housing code enforcement, tenants that are having repair problems where the landlord's being unresponsive, the options they really have are to sue the landlord for some sort of injunctive relief, which is, you know, it requires being able to pay for an attorney to do that. Tenants can legally withhold rent when landlords are failing to meet their obligations under state law for habitability requirements. But tenants, that's a course of action that we always recommend against, unless tenants have an attorney that's recommending they do that, because almost always if a tenant withholds rent, they'll receive a non-payment of rent eviction, and then they're forced to essentially prove their case around the repair issues in eviction court. And that's very risky for tenants in terms of both the rental history and the ability to use the legal system effectively.
So now the Safe Housing Project is going to address some of these issues, some of these challenges. So, Alisa, what is the Safe Housing Project?
It is a project that we do right now only in the city of Portland, because that's where we have the building code, and there's only one of me, and I can only do so much work. So we identify apartment complexes that have repair problems. So either through our hotline, or I have different caseworkers that will call me and ask me to come out and work in buildings. And they're identified through different city agencies as well that let me know of problems in apartment complexes. So we go out there, we talk to folks, and we try to work, get tenants to work with their neighbors to ask for repair problems. Usually if someone's having a problem in one unit, it kind of spreads throughout to the whole building. So one person's having like rats or mold or cockroaches, that stuff kind of tends to spread and affects everybody. So we work with folks so that way you aren't so isolated and you aren't the only one stepping forward and putting yourself out there. We try to get folks in at least a group of three or four to step up and ask for repairs together in order so that one person can't get picked off. And it's been a very successful program in buildings that we were able to organize in. So we'll write letters asking for repairs together. We'll call the building inspectors together and have everything done so that it doesn't look like it's one person that's doing it. And also, it's much harder to ignore a group of people asking for repairs who are organized than just one person. So
how do you do the organizing? Do you go out and have a meeting at the building?
There's different ways you can do it. Our information on how to organize, it's great if you feel comfortable and you can do it at the building. That's usually the best and it's most empowering and it's the fastest way, because usually if I have to go out and find a meeting place, it takes a bit longer to do the organizing work. But I go out with volunteers and tenants and go and door knock and have folks actually go out and talk to people. They knock on their doors, give them information, ask them if they're having repair problems. And a lot of people say yes, because they are having repair problems. It's very common. And people get excited to find out that there's people that care about mm-hmm. them and just to let them know that it's okay for them to ask for repairs and that it's not fair to be living in substandard housing conditions and that they're not the only one, too. A lot of people feel that they're the only ones suffering through these problems and that they have to keep dealing with it. So we'll have a meeting sometimes off-site, so that way people feel more comfortable coming to a meeting. And I'll do a renter's rights workshop and just go over the rights as a renter and the process of going about getting repairs done safely. And it's usually on the hotline and through our all programs, we tell people that they need to document their information a lot. And it's the safest way. It's the best way to protect themselves. So writing letters. People can go up and talk to their landlords or call them on the phone and ask for repairs. But if you have stuff in writing, it's proof that you have there showing that you really did ask for repairs. So they can't say later on, no, I didn't know about it. And then usually we do coordinate building inspections, and we collectively we pressure city inspectors to come out there and do as much as they can to try to get the repairs done immediately.
So, and this is KBOO 90.7 FM on your dial. This is the Hole in the Bucket show. I'm Michael Anderson, and I'm joined in the studio by Elisa Aguilera and Ian Slingerland from the Community Alliance of Tenants. And we're talking about habitable housing and the new safe housing program. We're going to take a music break in about a minute. But before we go to the music break, I think the information that you guys have to share tonight, there's probably a lot of people in our listening audience who may themselves have a repair issue, or they know somebody who has a repair issue who is in a place where they're afraid to come forward. So how would people – do people call the hotline to access the Safe Housing Program?
They can call our hotline and get information from there. And then if they sound excited about organizing or living in an apartment complex, I'll call them back. Or they can check out our website, and on there I do have my email address. And they can just – you can email me. And if folks just have questions and aren't ready to organize or go fully forward with working with your neighbors just yet and want more information, then feel free to email me.
Do you want to give out that email?
I sure can. It's elisa@organcat.org, and it's elisa@organcat.org.
Oregon Cat, one word, and that's the website too, OregonCat.org.
Yeah, and the website's just Oregon Cat.
Okay, we're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the Safe Housing Project and also about the mold relocation program that Cat has. This is Spaghetti Western doing 1860 Reprise.
You can have water.
Some money.
Welcome back to Hole in the Bucket. That was not Spaghetti Western. That was the godfather of soul himself, James Brown, the late great, singing, "You can have Watergate, just give me some bucks and I'll be straight." We'll hear a little bit from Spaghetti Western in a moment. But yeah, I need some money. I guess that's probably the sentiment of a lot of tenants as they hope to find a place that's decent for themselves, for their family. But back to our discussion here, we were talking about the Safe Housing Program, a program at CAT to help tenants organize so they collectively can get the repairs that they're legally entitled to. I want to talk a little bit more about what the Safe Housing Project has done so far. So there's been a number of successes. And I guess I have two questions about that. One is when you say that you do organizing in buildings, how many buildings have you been able to work with? And then the second thing that I'm always interested in is Community Alliance of Tenants has a history not just of helping and working with people, but helping people become leaders themselves, helping tenants, you know, take control of their own situations. And I wonder how the Safe Housing Project, how that's worked in terms of a place for leadership development. So about how many buildings do you think you guys have been working with?
About 10 in the last 2 years. About 10. It's very intense on my time to go out and do a lot of the research and help folks write letters and do all the footwork as much as possible. I do not go and talk to the landlords for people. I show people how to communicate with our landlords in good business practice ways in order so that way, in the future, if they ever have problems again, they're able to do it on their own. I want to empower them rather than enable them mm-hmm. with their work. And a lot of it is driven by what folks want, the issues that they want to take care of. And so there's been safety issues that people want to deal with at the same time as repairs. So our main focus is repairs. But if there's other issues going on, we definitely want to address those at the same time. So everything's driven by the tenants. It's not like I go out there and go and yell at the landlord and tell them what they need to do because I'm from CAT. It's folks. My name doesn't go on anything. I just show folks how to do everything on their own and help them walk through all the steps. And at the same time, sometimes some additional advocacy is necessary. So we've had folks, tenants from different buildings, go and talk to the city commissioners or send them a letter letting them know this process is taking a long time. We deserve our repairs, and we pay our rent on time. We're good people. We've been here in these homes for about 5 years. What are you going to do to help me get my repairs done? And mm-hmm. so it's been good. And a myth that some folks have is that tenants aren't invested in their neighborhoods. But almost every building I've worked in, the majority of folks have been there for 5 or 10 years or so. And so, I mean, that's a pretty big investment mm-hmm. to be there mm-hmm. for that long. And folks move there for a reason. I mean, it's close to their shopping. It's close to their doctor's offices. It's close to the schools that they like, their work. And so a lot of people don't want to move. They kind of want to move just because they want the repairs. But if they have their choice, they would rather have the repairs so that they could stay there. I mean, to pick up and move and change everything is quite hectic and very expensive as well. So,
about the leadership development, I know that particularly one of the things that I've been involved with your organization and something we've talked a lot about in the show is the urban renewal set aside. Some of your tenant leaders who were so effective in that process, weren't they engaged with the Safe Housing Project?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a great program for us in terms of working directly with tenants to assist them in getting immediate improvements in their lives. But it really that through that process, we're developing strong relationships with folks that have a lot of direct experience and expertise in the issues facing low income people, who then stay involved with CAT to address the root causes that folks are facing that contribute to these problems. For us, the Safe Housing Project is not just about winning immediate improvements in people's buildings and then moving on, but really about using that process both to develop leadership and develop our expertise to identify policy level changes that are going to impact tenants broadly, so that it's not just the 10 buildings that we're in every couple of years, but there's impact for all low income renters. And so folks have been real active in not just our campaigns around safe housing, but our campaigns around affordable housing, but also in developing proposals for changing how the code enforcement system works, changing how the industry is regulated to bring positive changes for renters throughout Portland.
So the Safe Housing Project, and then you have the Mold Relocation Program, which we're going to start talking about now. Is the Mold Relocation Program part of Safe Housing, or is it an addition?
It came sort of it.
The Mold Relocation Program is something that we're active in helping administrate, but it's really more of a victory than something a program for us. It's while there's still a lot of work to do, the City of Portland has been relatively responsive to some of the issues that we raise around shortcomings with the code enforcement system. One of the problems that exists in the code enforcement system, besides it just being a complaint-driven system, is that the penalties for landlords who have code violations right now are fairly small. And so where landlords are reluctant, it doesn't provide a lot of incentive. The penalty that they pay each month is much less than what rent is. And their tactics leans against the property, so they can just sit there building up these fines against their property over time, and it doesn't provide a financial incentive for them to make the repairs. And so the additional tool that the city has right now around that is taking a landlord to a code hearing, and then the code hearings officer has the ability to levy much higher fines and a lot more ability to take action that actually results in repairs getting made. But the experience we had was that was almost never happening. It never got to the point where they were taking landlords to code hearings to force repairs. The cases would be open 2 years before they'd review them to see if they should take them to code hearing. And
like two years, meaning 2 years without heat?
Yeah,
sometime. Well,
I mean, not in every time, but the point is we're talking about basic stuff.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
should legally be met, and for 2 years it would just keep going on and on.
There's a gentleman who's on our board now who got engaged the Safe Housing Project, and it was through him and his neighbors really putting a lot of pressure on the city to take their owner to a code hearing that they had their repairs resolved. And at the point that had happened, it had been eight months,
and that was heavy pressure from CAT and attorneys and the tenants.
And so they've the city, to their credit, has instituted a system now that, depending on the severity of the problem that's identified, pushes cases to code hearings at a much faster. And so that's a huge victory for tenants, that the cases won't sit now for as long before further actions taken by the city. And then another big victory that's happened is the Mold Relocation Program that you mentioned. One of the things that we've found as we started the Safe Housing Project and we're organizing in buildings, that we had a sense of but didn't really understand the true impact of, was the extent to which there's a connection between housing conditions and tenants' health. And Elisa spoke a little earlier about particularly asthma and young kids and the impact on kids' health that substandard housing conditions were having, particularly around mold. And one of the things that the city historically has had a relocation program tied to its code enforcement program, but it's really designed – it was designed only for cases where the city – forced tenants to vacate a building because it was in such poor condition. And generally that only happened in cases where there was a fire or something that really destroyed a building. And in those cases, tenants could access some assistance for relocation. And one of the things that we were finding was that there was these cases where families were getting sick as a result of the conditions of their housing. And the city decided to open up that relocation program in terms of eligibility to low-income tenant families that were having health problems that were associated with mold in their units.
So in
And lead exposure. That was a lot of us pushing kind of like these health issues that were really affecting tenants in a pretty bad way.
So then I guess I got a little confused. So the mold relocation or lead relocation program is not something that CAT runs, but rather something that you helped get into place and then you help people access?
Yeah. So the mold relocation program, you can call our hotline and get information on how to access it, but you do need to have medical documentation that the mold is aggravating your symptoms. And we have the handouts so that doctors can sign off. And it's not saying that the mold is causing these problems, because we don't want to get too tricky with doctors and the legal system, but it's aggravating the symptoms. And then also they need to have the mold cited by the building inspections program. And so once you have those two things and you meet the income requirements, you are eligible for that program. You do have to call us in order for us to refer you into the program, but it's not fully administered by us, and the funds aren't from us.
Now, is it going to be obvious to people that they have a mold problem in their apartment, or are there things that people should know what to look for?
Sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it's not. Generally, the cases we're dealing with are it's because it's driven by folks contacting us. It's that tenants are aware of the problem. Sometimes there, although I can think of a hotline story where there was a huge mold problem that was in the attic that folks didn't know about until they went up in the attic one day and saw this huge mold problem and then sort of started piecing things together and found that there was some connection between that mold and the sickness that they'd been experiencing since they moved into the house. But generally what we see is that it's where folks are contacting us is it's visible mold that people are seeing. I don't know, is that your experience?
It's visible mold. And usually when I go and talk to folks, it's sometimes they might not have pieced it together, but I have learned in my experience, you know, kind of the symptoms of mold. And it's really hard because they're just general common cold things. A lot of people think that they have a cold that just won't go away, or they have sinus problems that just won't go away, or this new asthma that's developed. But after a while, they can figure out, you know, hey, I feel much better when I'm not in my house and then I'm outside, or when I'm on vacation, I feel much better. But every time I come in the house, I'm sick all over again.
You know, it particularly strikes me, and not that it would be good for anybody to experience extensive mold, but I was thinking, Ian, you know, you were talking about the exposure of children, and then at least I think you gave an example of that. You've gone into units and heard, you know, young infants really rasping. And it just strikes me, you know, a lot of times we struggle as a society to look at, you know, particularly issues around generational poverty and what's going on. But boy, like if you're a kid who's supposed to be at a learning age, going to school and everything, but in your own house where you should be doing homework, playing, relaxing, you're getting sick and sicker. I mean, that seems like that's almost a perpetuating cycle that just keeps putting that family behind the eight ball.
Sure. And it's both in terms of kids missing school, when they're school-aged kids, but then also parents, regardless of how old the kids are, having to stay home with their kids and missing work because they don't have childcare options and their kids are sick and out of school. It can be devastating in terms of loss of income that then just can escalate into other problems as folks miss work, so they don't have that income, sometimes lose jobs, and then they don't have the money to pay rent. And then, so it's a huge problem that goes beyond just the immediate health consequences for families. I just wanted to touch back on one of the things that Elisa mentioned about mold. One of the problems, you know, mold's a growing issue in terms of awareness for folks. And one of the problems with mold in terms of policy responses is that the symptoms that folks have or the illnesses that folks have, like asthma, there can be a lot of variables that contribute to that. And so it's very difficult for tenants to find a doctor that will say your sickness is the result of mold, because it's hard for them to know with certainty. And so one of the ways that the city program is good about responding to that is it doesn't put that high of a barrier on doctors. It just doctors need to say that they have symptoms or an illness that could be attributable to mold. And then that's enough to make tenants on the medical side eligible for the program. And then part of why CAT has a role in helping tenants access that is then we work with the tenants to understand what their responsibilities are to the landlord in terms of notice, if there's a lease, what their rent obligation is, those sorts of things, because it's a relatively low barrier on the medical side to get in, but it doesn't really punish the landlord at all because they're getting their full rent. It's really about just moving the family out of that situation because it seems to be contributing to their poor health.
So one of the other things that I really wanted to address with you, and I think I talked to both of you guys about this before the show started, but, you know, there's so many false mythologies about people who are experiencing poverty. You know, and one is that, you know, the having a dirty place, you know, the rundown apartment, you know, somehow that emanates from the family themselves, that somehow because they're low income, that means they don't really clean. But one of the things that we talked about is that, you know, in a lot of the housing that people can afford, there are chronic issues with the building that affect, you know, even in the best case, how possibly clean you could make your apartment. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more? I think you sort of touched on it, that it's usually not one unit. If you find something in one unit, it can be the whole building. Or...
Yeah. With mold, there are a few different ways that you can get mold. So one is you could have poor ventilation systems in your unit. So that just means that you have too much moisture that can't get out of your unit. And so... that's one way. And then another way is you have water damage, some type of water damage or constant leaking that's creating the mold. So mold grows from water. And then also if you have excess water, we found that there's rodents too because they feed off that, which is a separate issue. But so folks will – every time I've gone into some place that has mold problems, people are cleaning. Like, I have never seen somebody clean so much when they have mold. They're just out there, they're cleaning, they're bringing out whatever chemicals they can to get rid of it because not only does it look bad, it's also making them sick and they know it. So it's not that. When I've gone in, I've checked to see if fans are working, like if the fan in the bathroom is working. Oftentimes it's not. So people who are, while they're showering, after they're showering, they're turning the fan on, if it's not working, it's not going to do anything. That water is not going to go anywhere except for settle on the ceiling and the corners and start to grow mold. Also, if there's water damage, I mean, if there's a constant leak and it's not getting repaired, it just keeps spilling. Like, you can have towels down there, you can have buckets, but water still spills. And some of the wood that's being used to construct some cabinets and whatnot and the flooring, I mean, that just gets – it rots. So a lot of it I haven't seen in my experience that it's from people not cleaning enough. It's just, you know, they don't have the appropriate tools that they need in order to take care of it.
Well, and mold is never a cleaning issue. Mold's a moisture issue. It has nothing to do with the cleaning habits of someone. It exists because there's a moisture problem, and the reasons for moisture problems, Elisa talked about. I think with mold and pests, whether it's rodents or cockroaches, with all of those things, regardless of whether you're a homeowner or a tenant, there are certain things that you can do to address those issues. There's things tenants can do to limit moisture in their house. There's things that tenants can do to remove food sources for things. But the difference for tenants is often that's not enough, and they don't have the ability to do the other things that are going to remedy the problem. Mm-hmm. If there is significant water damage, if there's water leaking to a unit from outside, if there's inadequate ventilation, those are things that are outside of the responsibility or ability of the tenant to address. And so it requires action on the part of the owner of the property to address those. Similarly with rodents, I think with rats, one of the things that rats are an issue in terms of both having access points that aren't the responsibility of the tenant to get. So it's access points into the housing. And often there's a connection where when rat problems start between a lack of adequate garbage service is what attracts mm-hmm. rats to the property and what keeps them around. And so again, that's not anything that is in the control of the tenant.
So in some ways, too, it would seem that there's a certain irony here, that the fact that tenants can't have their repairs made in a timely, regularly fashion. So, for instance, your fan goes down in your bathroom or your kitchen. If you could call and get that repaired in a timely fashion, it might avoid all these other things that happen that now just, I imagine, not only jeopardize the health of the family, but it seems a little bit ultimately short-sighted on the landlord's part because
they
lose
some of their building, the integrity of the building. Yeah. And it just kind of goes down until they take care of it. The other thing is with mold, a lot of industry professionals have these myths as well with them. And we've heard different industry professionals say to tenants, you know, if you just clean more, if you shower less, if you cook less. And it's just like, you know, the shower is built to take a shower. Because then they'd complain that they weren't showering enough later on. Or if they weren't cooking, I mean, they're supposed to go out to eat every single meal just because they're not supposed to be cooking. If we had fans that were built to actually remove the moisture in there, it wouldn't be a problem. And if tenants were showed properly how to use it. A lot of folks, when I go in there, don't know that their fan isn't working because they don't know how to check to see if their fan is working. And they think that the hood fan, which really often just sucks up the grease, they think it's sucking out the moisture too, but if it's not built to do that, it's not going to perform that function. So folks just need to be shown how to.
And I think this is an area where there's both regulatory and incentive options to address the problem. I mean, one of the things that you see, this is an example that's used a lot with mold, is old aluminum single pane windows. That aluminum, you know, water condenses on that, and it often contributes to mold problems as water sits there. But those are up to code. You know, that itself is not a violation of code, and landlords wouldn't have a reason to know when those buildings were built that would lead to a problem down the line. And so trying to identify ways to support rehabbing those buildings in a way that there's some reasonable return to the public in addition to regulating where there's problems is one of the things we'd like to see more of.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I have to tell you, every single show, I feel like when I have people in the studio, all of a sudden I'm saying, all right, we're at the end of our conversation time, and it feels like there's so much more we can say. We have a pre-taped segment that I want to get to that's also around, I mean, if we've just been in a lot of ways talking about environmental justice within the unit, this next piece that we're going to play after a small musical break is going to be about brownfields and exterior environmental justice. But before we leave again, I just want you to repeat the contact information for our listeners. So how about the website, and then Elisa, if you'd give your email again.
Ian's going to have to give a hotline phone number because I don't have that memorized.
It's the hotline is 503-288-0130. And again, the message box may be full, but keep trying.
Yeah. It's late morning. I'll give you a hint. Late morning is a good time to call Monday through Thursday. It's when we clear out the messages. And then my email is elisa@oregoncat.org, and it's elisa@oregoncat.org. And then our website, fabulous website with handouts on there, information that you would need is to either get involved in the organization or for your rights as a renter, is www.oregoncat.org.
Super. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Hole in the Bucket. And this is Spaghetti Western.
Thank you. I'm Kelly. Today we're going to do an interview with people who are active at the intersection of housing, environmental issues, poverty, and the access to public decision-making that affects our lives and the development of our communities. Let's jump right in with introductions.
I'm Kevin O'Dell. I'm the director and lead organizer for OPAL, which is Organizing People Activating Leaders. It's a recently formed nonprofit group focused on environmental justice issues and the low-income neighborhoods of Portland Metro. And I'm going to be talking about environmental justice today, and specifically talking about a project called Groundwork Portland, which I'm a part of and is a community-based collaborative that's focused on brownfield redevelopment and land use and built environment issues from an environmental justice perspective.
Welcome, Kevin. Let's meet our other guest.
I'm Clark Henry, City Portland Brownfield Program, and Groundwork Portland Steering Committee member. Proud to be.
Let's start with some detail about what environmental justice means.
Environmental justice has a whole bunch of different sort of definitions. We have and most of the most standard ones come from government. So basically environmental justice is specific to low-income people of color. So low-income communities and people of color communities traditionally living next to land use or environmental hazards. So if the EPA was to sort of give you a definition, they would say the disproportionate burden of communities as related to zoning, land use, etc. And so commonly when we look at environmental justice, we start focusing on low-income communities and why these communities have highways put through them, or why a lot of these fence line communities are next to polluting organizations or corporations, or communities next to industrial areas. So if you can think of what your great communities are and what creates a great community, 9 out of 10 times your communities that are lacking a lot of those great sort of incentives are environmental justice communities.
Clark, can you connect the dots between environmental justice and housing?
Low-income areas with housing that is available and inhabited by low-income individuals are also these neighborhoods where different things get cited, such as landfills and incinerators. Industrial uses are really, the housing around industrial uses are generally not high-income housing. These are low-income housing.
We've got a clip from Paulette Haig, a local community activist, who shares her opinion on this topic.
We definitely should be given justice. As an African-American woman who comes from a modest financial background, it's been my experience that we always get the rough end of the deal. You build apartments around dumps. Those are the inexpensive apartments, and that's where we're put. We all need to be treated fairly, regardless of our socioeconomic group.
Issues of fairness and environmental justice come into play when we talk about the redevelopment of brownfields and other types of community development. But what are brownfields? Clark, will you tell us?
The technical definition of a brownfield is very wonky. It's, let's see if I can quote verbatim from the EPA, it's like real property whose expansion or redevelopment has been hindered by the presence or perception of contamination. Now, in just real terms, it's the corner gas station that's been abandoned for 30 years. It's the industrial site that no one's using. It's the abandoned building that nobody uses.
Now that we've got some clear definitions of the issues, can you tell us about the project you two are involved in?
Groundwork Portland, part of a larger network called Groundwork USA, is a new organization that we're forming right now.
One of the goals of Groundwork Portland is identifying these brownfields in the target communities that we're looking at, so low-income communities of color, and working to address how this sort of redeveloped property can be a positive thing for that community.
Most of the times that brownfields are redeveloped, it's through the private market, and so you get a certain population of people who are actually benefiting from them. These might not be uses that people from the community actually benefit from. Higher-end housing than they're able to afford, different types of retail opportunities, places where they're not necessarily receiving a benefit or employment, other than just the general benefit of having a site used in for some purpose. Now, Groundwork is really intended to serve as a vehicle for these people to use. It's wide open. We don't have any predetermined use for any of the sites. and really depend on community need. You know, if they need, you know, we have kind of a focus that is directed by the people at Groundwork USA who are funding us, that the general direction is to reclaim derelict property for the use of parks, open space, gardens, etc. But it's wide open in terms of what their future can be.
How can people in Portland be active around environmental justice?
There are a number of organizations in town for which they can volunteer and learn and go to different events. If they're part of a neighborhood association, they can just attend different associations that they're a part of and make sure that this topic is on their agenda. It often gets overlooked as something that's not really impacting a particular community. But it's a major focal point for many communities, and I think it needs to be addressed specifically as a topic rather than as a sidebar to another issue, which it sometimes is. Justice is the quality of the housing in which they inhabit. You know, we've done a lot of studies, even just here in Portland, that identified lead, mold, trash, and brownfields as major problems around some of the public housing properties that we have in North Portland and Northeast Portland and in Outer Southeast.
Does Groundwork have a website?
Absolutely. www.opalpdx.org. That's opalpdx.org. It'll have a few short pages on our history, how we've become an organization, some of the organizing projects we're currently working to address right now, and sort of like the five-year vision of what we see for environmental justice in Portland Metro.
Is there other contact information available for our listeners?
Yes, there is. You can email me, kevin@opalpdx.org, or you can call 503-997-3853. 503-997-3853. And that will get you a lot more information.
That wraps up our interview today. Many thanks to my guests, Clark Henry, Kevin O'Dell, and Paulette Haig. And thank you for listening to KBOO.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelly. That was a good report about the Groundworks project. You can find out more. I understand the Opal website is going to be down for the next 2 weeks, but it'll be up shortly. So I am signing off. This is Michael Anderson for Hole in the Bucket on KBOO 90.7 FM. Our next Hole in the Bucket, we are on twice this month. We're on the fifth Wednesday, which means on the 31st, you can tune in to hear about the VOES Worker Education Project. The guest will be Romero Soso. Also, we'll be talking with Catherine Houston Souza about homeless Iraqi vets, one of the gifts that the war unfortunately keeps giving. So please tune in 6 to 7 on the 31st of the month to Hole in the Bucket, and keep on rocking.
Rocking in the free world. Keep on.